Well, let's now move to the program for tonight. And my role will be to introduce our moderator or interviewer, someone who's not a stranger to the Federalist Society, one of the great judges in the Seventh Circuit. Judge Diane Sykes has had the opportunity to serve at a lower court judge, but also a state Supreme Court judge, and now on the Seventh Circuit. She's one of the great nominees that President Bush made back in 2004, and we appreciate that. And I won't ask her to go into discussing her own opinions, but she had a very good one recently in one of the healthcare cases. So I'm going to let her introduce our featured guest and conduct the interview. But without further ado, let's welcome Judge Sykes.
Thank you, David, and good evening, everyone. It's my great honor and pleasure to introduce our distinguished guest this evening, although much of what I might say by way of introduction is no doubt familiar to all of you. Justice Clarence Thomas has served with great distinction on the United States Supreme Court for more than two decades now, and he has been a friend of the Federalist Society for so long that most of you in this room already know him very well. But I think it's right for us to recall the extraordinary path that he traveled to reach our nation's highest court, not only for what it tells us about him, but for what it tells us about our country. As Justice Thomas himself put it in his remarkable memoir, My Grandfather's Son, I have never doubted the greatness of a country in which a person like me could travel all the way from Pinpoint, Georgia, to our nation's capital. Clarence Thomas is descended from West African slaves who worked on a rice plantation in Georgia. He was born in Pinpoint, a tiny coastal settlement near Savannah, into circumstances of extreme poverty and deprivation. There was no running water in the shanty where he lived, and only a single electric light. His father abandoned the family. When he was six, the house burned down, and his mother moved with Clarence and his brother to a squalid tenement in Savannah, where the living conditions were deplorable and there was a shortage of food. His mother could not raise the boys on the $10 a week she earned as a housekeeper. So when Clarence was seven, he and his younger brother were sent to live with their grandparents. Their influence on him, especially that of his grandfather, Myers Anderson, was life-changing. As told in his wonderful memoir, his grandfather's self-reliance and ethic of hard work and personal responsibility, his Catholic faith and insistence on the primacy of education, and his personal dignity and strength in the face of the injustices of the segregated South taught our future Supreme Court justice everything he needed to know to meet the challenges and opportunities that were ahead of him. The Sisters of St. Benedict and St. Pius added a few things, too. Initially, young Clarence Thomas was called to the priesthood, and he entered the seminary. But the call gradually lost its strength, and a cruel and bigoted comment by another seminarian extinguished his vocation. He left the seminary and in the fall of 1968 enrolled at Holy Cross College. Yale Law School came next, but after earning the elite Yale JD, he had difficulty finding a big city law firm job. So he accepted an offer from John Danforth, then the Attorney General of Missouri, and served as an Assistant Attorney General in Jefferson City from 1974 to 1977. After a brief stint in corporate law, he followed then-Senator Danforth to Washington, D.C. in 1979, just in time for the Reagan Revolution. Over the next dozen years, Clarence Thomas served in all three branches of government. As a legislative aide to Senator Danforth, as Assistant Secretary for Civil Rights in the Department of Education, as Chairman of the Equal Opportunity Employment Commission, and as a circuit judge on the United States Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit. Along the way, he met and married Virginia, his soulmate. In 1991, he was appointed to the Supreme Court by President George H.W. Bush. By this time, he had emerged as an outspoken conservative, so the confirmation process exacted a personal toll. But by following the example of his grandfather, he persevered. And our nation is very fortunate that he did. On the court, Justice Thomas has been a steady and committed originalist, playing a pivotal role in the recovery and restoration of the original meaning method of constitutional interpretation. He has made substantial and important contributions to our law, both in his opinions for the court and when writing separately, perhaps most notably in the areas of federalism and the separation of powers, the jurisprudence of equal protection, the guarantee of trial by jury, and the law of free political speech. His opinions reflect a deep appreciation for the liberty-protecting structure of our constitutional system. He has advanced an understanding of the Constitution informed by the vital truths expressed in the Declaration of Independence, connecting our founding political and juridical documents. His extraordinary personal fortitude is an inspiration to all who would stand on principle. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Clarence Thomas, Associate Justice of the Supreme Court.
That's so embarrassing.
Justice Thomas, good evening, and it's so good to see you again. he was really loose at the table, so I think this is going to be a lot of fun.
Thank you.
As I talked about in the introduction, Justice Thomas, your path to the court is a truly remarkable American story. So what I'd like to do is begin our discussion this evening sort of in the middle of the story with your decision to go to law school. That was really your genesis, or the genesis of your journey in the law. You had left the seminary and were a student at Holy Cross. It was the late 1960s, a very turbulent time for our country. You had decided to go to law school, and you were accepted at some of the best law schools in the country. As I recall from your memoir, you said you turned down Harvard Law School in favor of Yale because Harvard was too big and too conservative. Now, I get the big part, but the conservative part I think you're going to have to explain.
First of all, Judge Sykes, thank you for your introduction. I think I should have just quit while I was ahead. This is really embarrassing. There's a lot of attention on me, and it kind of just makes you uncomfortable. But, you know, I think when you come up from a part of the country and you're in New England, there are a lot of things that are happening in your life. I had quit the seminary, which was, you know, the only dream I'd ever really had. And I'd been a devout Catholic, an altar boy, and I had eschewed all those things in 1968. So like most kids who eschew the way they're raised, you're adrift. And you're looking for the next vocation. Everybody who's been a seminarian thinks he or she has a vocation if you're in the convent or if you're trying to be a priest. So that's your orientation. And I thought that law would be a substitute vocation, something similar to the priesthood, where you did well so that you could do good, so that you could go back home and do the right thing. That was all there was to it. Now, that's about as deep as it got. I mean, this is 1968, 69, and Woodstock is going on, so that would be considered very sane thinking.
Well, you were something of a campus radical, weren't you?
Yeah, but I wasn't a dopehead.
I'm glad to hear that.
So, you know, the 60s were different. And there were a lot of things happening involving race, the breakdown in the structure in society. I was suddenly out of the seminary and in New England. And there were no rules. Things were falling apart. And you know, without structure, it's very, very difficult to navigate. I was extremely fortunate to be at Holy Cross. I was extremely fortunate to still have had a residuum of the way I was raised by and the structure that the nuns had given me, the structure that the seminary had given me. I was also extremely fortunate because I had already been in predominantly white schools. I was the only black kid in my high school in Savannah. So the transition to a school with very few blacks in a very difficult set of circumstances, academically and otherwise, I had sort of a jump start. I was ahead of the game, so I had something. So it allowed me to continue to do well, even though it was very, very difficult. Now, I do want to get to Harvard, though. I don't want to get lost in that. Just, I was a bit of a radical, but that's what happened back then. You were black, things were changing, and we were very, very upset. That changed, actually, at a riot in Harvard Square, when I finally realized this is going too far, and that I'm full of this hatred that, as my grandfather would often tell me when he saw me, you were not raised to be that way. And it was, I can give you the exact date, it's the road to Damascus date, was the morning of April 16, 1970. The day after Harry Blackmun was announced for the Supreme Court. We were in the exact same newspaper, that's how I knew. Having come back from that riot at Harvard Square, not understanding exactly what I had just done, I stood in front of the chapel at Holy Cross, and that's where I made a promise to God that I would, if he could help me take hate, get this hatred out of my heart, I would never hate again. And it's sort of ironic when I hear people try to tell me that I am supposed to be overwhelmingly race conscious and have this sense of get even in sort of effort to get even in my life, that's the opposite of the way I was raised. That was the opposite of what we believed in. And it was the opposite of the deal I made with God on April 16, 1970. Now, with respect to Harvard, I set Harvard as a dream. I had no plans. I mean, what do I know about Harvard? I'm from Savannah, Georgia. Harvard, I may as well say Harvard, Mars, doesn't make any difference. As someone said to me, why not just say Mars, since that's as impossible as Harvard? And just sort of laughed at me in 1969 or so when I said that. So it was a reach for me, not quite understanding it. But I was confused. You remember that's the era we're selling Black Panther papers? We're like meeting at the radical bookstore and wondering why the FBI is looking at us. You know, if you meet at a store with a little red book behind you, other people might be interested in what you're doing. So, and they're not all called NSA. So, But at any rate, the you know, I went. I was accepted to my surprise, and I went to Cambridge. And I remember that there was a lot of people there in the law school, and it was very confusing. And I escaped from that madness. It's sort of like the scene you see in The Stranger by Camus. You know, like you have this weird experience out there. And so that was sort of what happened to me at Harvard. And I sort of like became like breathless, and oh my goodness, a panic attack. And I got back to Holy Cross and said, there's absolutely no way I can go there. And it was a big, it was all these people walking around dressed up like they were going into the corporate world. And of course, back then we were anti-corporations. And I decided to go to Penn, actually. I had not been accepted at Yale. And so I was gonna go to Penn Law School. And Yale had sent me, Yale isn't like the other law schools. You knew you were accepted if they sent a big packet of materials. Yale sent the thinnest of letters. It was as though, I mean, we are not into the catalog thing. We are Yale. So, not only that, they sent it to my grandparents in Savannah, Georgia, who never opened my mail because they couldn't read what was in it, so they never looked in it. And they eventually sent it to me, so I get this thin letter from Yale, the Yale Law School. And I went to Yale, and quite frankly, as bad as the things are that I may have said about Yale, the experience was very beneficial to me. So,
and what were you hoping to do with your law degree?
Go to Savannah, Georgia.
Go back home.
I've never had any other dream but to return to Savannah, Georgia. That's my number one dream. I was going to become a priest to go and help. I was going to become a lawyer to go and help. It was that simple. And I couldn't get a job in my state of Georgia. It's that simple. I mean, some people make it very complicated. I could not get a job. And I looked at the firms in Atlanta. I looked at lots of places. I got zero job offers. Jack Danforth, a good man. The biggest problem that I had with him is he was a Republican. But I got over it when I had only had one job offer.
Well, tell us about what that first job meant to you in your future.
It was the best job I've ever had. I learned things from Jack Danforth that I would learn from other good people. One, I learned that you don't judge people with these labels, a Republican versus this or that. I also learned that you can treat people fairly and be decent and honest with everybody. He was always absolutely honest and ethical. And in watching him be that way, you learn how to be that way with others. He was a compassionate man also. He was very good to me. I every day thank God that along the way, again, remember, I had absolutely no one to give me guidance. I thank God I met so many good people. I can even remember my years at EEOC and being protected by people like Orrin Hatch and Strom Thurmond. I didn't know Strom Thurmond. I just met Senator Hatch. But I had over 60 hearings at EEOC, and some of those were pretty brutal hearings. And yet, every time the people I could count on in the Senate were Orrin Hatch and Strom Thurmond. But in any case, that job meant everything to me because it was a model for how I would conduct myself and what I would expect in the future.
Well, let's talk about your decision to come to D.C. In 1979. At that point, a major political shift was underway. What is now called the conservative legal movement came just a few years later. When you came here, your arrival coincided with this shift. Was that just a coincidence, or did you come with an affinity for the legal ideas of the Reagan Revolution?
Oh, God, no. I was trying to get to Savannah. I was getting promoted in a job that was a fine job with good people, but that's not why I went to law school. And as I said then, I was beginning to feel the golden handcuffs closed, and I wanted out. So I quit my job impetuously. I do things like that. And I had thought about it. I quit my job in 1979. I was 31 years old, packed up a U-Haul and moved. And fortuitously, again, good people looking out for me, Senator Danforth offered me a job. And so I came here, and I was only going to stay a couple of years, and then I was going to Savannah. And one thing led to another, and I wound up on the court.
Just like that.
People come up with all these things. I love people with bad intent write these things, and sort of like how you did this or did that. It was like totally Forrest Gump, you know? I just did my jobs, and then I showed up in these pictures, and one day I showed up in a picture at Kenneth Bunkport. I wish I could give you a better story than that. But.
Well, there must have been people that you turned to. There must have been people you turned to for
advice. Well, my bride, she and I met her in 1986, and that was the beginning of me going back to the things that were most important in my life. And we prayed about everything that happened after that. Good people who believed in me, like President Bush. I didn't know President Bush when he nominated me to the D.C. Circuit. My good friend Ricky Silberman, who insisted that I think about it. There were Larry Silberman, who counseled me about it. At every turn, and it'll probably be boring to you all because my life actually is pretty boring. There were a series of good people who showed up, because one of the things that became a priority, and if you talk to people who come to new places and they don't have family, you could ask anybody in this room who don't have a structured family, you begin to assemble a family. That was the source of my difficulty with Yale. Yale had become the only family that I had, and then at a critical juncture, they abandoned me. That was the big problem. It wasn't when I was at Yale. So at every point you build a family, and the people I just mentioned to you became the sort of substitute family. You think about it. My wife goes with me. My wife and I are really pretty, really close. And we spend a lot of time together. And so we go down to Savannah, and she sees the family structure, and it is the pathology in many ways of the experiments, the social experiments of the 60s. My grandparents are gone, so that anchor is gone. And so I'm sort of without that base. So you begin to look for people to fill that in. And the people I've just mentioned to you who gave me that guidance, who looked out for me, became that substitute, that ersatz family. And it was very important to me. So I always think that I'm blessed because God, I think, sent all these good people. He sent my wife. My wife is a gift that I prayed for in the 1980s. The people, I got to the court, and my friend Justice Scalia was there. And it was a godsend. We quickly became friends and looked out for me, that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. So just in the way that Orrin Hatch and Strom Thurmond looked out for me, or that Jack Danforth looked out for me.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's turn now to your time on the court. Mm-hmm. 3 weeks ago, you marked your 22nd anniversary.
I did.
And
oh, my goodness.
Well, I didn't need to look that up because I have my own personal marker. My son, Alex, whom you met earlier this evening, who's with me here today, was born 2 days after you took your seat on the court. So he's my own little personal marker of your anniversary.
Right? I hope you didn't waste any of your time watching my ordeal.
He was 2 weeks late, so.
Wow. So at least that sort of at least kept your mind off that.
It did. It did.
I'm trying to look for the good side of that.
Why don't you, if you would, share a few thoughts on your initial transition to the court. How did you get your bearings on the court? Who gave you advice? How did you learn the ways of the court?
Well, first of all, I came from the D.C. Circuit. The people there were fabulous. Absolutely fabulous. I got advice from my good friend Larry Silberman, who was just a wonderful mentor on the D.C. circuit for the entire 15 months, and continued to be a friend afterwards. When I got to the court, I was enormously blessed. Byron White was still there, a good man. But my closest ally and friend when I got there was Justice Scalia. Mm-hmm. At the expense of embarrassing him, at the risk of embarrassing him, I can honestly say that as beat up as I was when I got there with the workload, I don't know how I would have gotten through it if he hadn't been there. Mm-hmm. He became quickly a friend. I mean, he became family. He and Maureen became. It wasn't that we always agreed in every case, although we agreed quite a bit. It's I could count on him, and that I could trust him, that I could go and talk to him. There were days when. I was getting beat up quite a bit, and he was a friend more than, he was a friend and a colleague, but oftentimes a friend, and just very kind to me. The members of the court were delightful to me. The Chief Justice, Rehnquist, the Justice Marshall, all of them, Justice Brennan, and they all gave me, I think, sage advice. But in the end, I think my closest, the person who made it doable, was Justice Scalia.
Tell us what's changed during your tenure on the court.
God, I'm older. the court's changed. It's really interesting. I have to take my hat off to people like John Stevens and Bill Rehnquist, the people who've been there a long time, because after you've been there a while, you sort of come of age with a court, and that you get used to that, and then it changes. And new colleagues come on, and you make adjustments, and they become your family. And it's a different court when you have different colleagues. And you go, they're good people, all of them. I mean, we've been enormously fortunate. We have Justice Alito's there now. We were at Yale together. He and Martha Ann have become family. You meet new people and you get new colleagues and new friends. But I have to say that with all that, I think I look back on those days that I came of age as the years that I will treasure, because they were really, really hard. And I feel like you take Justice Scalia, we were in the trenches together. And you learn a lot, and you treasure now, the moments now, but you really look back on those days as the critical days. Mm-hmm. I don't think I've been there so long now, you've seen a lot, but back then you were quite fresh and you were a novice.
Has the style of the presentation of the cases changed at all?
I don't know.
The oral arguments?
I don't know. There are a lot of briefs and people doing a lot of talking. I know. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, it's law. And I must say, when I went on the court, I was resisted being a judge. I really, that was not what I would have picked in my life. But it's your J-O-B, so you do it. But now you get to a point, you see it, and it goes from being what you're doing, it becomes an avocation. This is what you're called to do. This is what I do. It's not that the words have changed, but the way you read them, the way you absorb them. I never thought that I would treasure doing my job. And I have reached that point. Even the most boring cases to others are fascinating. You know, one of my clerks today was saying to me, I was reading some draft opinions and working on one of mine. He said, "Oh gosh, you need to really put on your green eye shade." I said, "I think it's fascinating." And see, I think he wanted to say there's medication for that. But it is really, I've gotten to a point where it's like the priesthood. This is what I was called to do. And I wouldn't say enjoy, but I love what I do.
Well, some things to observers from the outside have definitely changed at the Supreme Court. We've had the rise of the specialty Supreme Court bar, of course, and I don't know if that's changed the way the cases are presented, the quality of the oral arguments.
It's like the rise of the gargoyles or something. They're not all that bad.
Okay, next question.
You know, okay. Well, I don't know why there's a rise. You know, I don't know the legal profession that well. I just show up and do my stuff.
Okay, something else that's definitely changed, I think, as an observer, is the kind and degree of attention that is paid to the court and its work.
I don't follow the attention that's paid, though. Okay.
So, I mean, we now have SCOTUS blog, and we
I know nothing about that.
So, okay. So you don't read the new media?
Oh, God, no. Oh. You know, I make
it a
point.
Do you read the old media?
I don't read anything. I try not to read anything about what we do because I was there.
Okay. Fair
I
enough.
I really don't. I don't read. I just, that's hearsay.
Fair enough. We'll move on. Okay.
I am sorry I am the way I am. I really am.
Okay, moving on. I think it's fair to say that you're the most consistent originalist on the Supreme Court. Sorry, Justice Scalia.
No, he said something like I was a cold-blooded originalist or something.
Faint-hearted.
What'd you say I was?
But now I read recently that he says now he's a stout-hearted originalist.
Oh, I am or he is?
He is.
Okay,
now.
Well, he
no
is.
No longer faint-hearted, now stout-hearted.
No, he's a courageous originalist and a brilliant one. That's right. There's no doubt.
But I think it is fair to say that you are the justice who is most willing to re-examine the court's precedents and
that's
reconsider.
Because of my affinity for stare decisis.
Well, that's... That's what I was going to ask you about. Stare decisis doesn't hold much force for you.
Oh, it sure does, but not enough to keep me from going to the Constitution. Oh, God. Oh, goodness. So I guess they don't care much for stare decisis either.
Well,
I don't mean to make light of stare decisis.
Yeah, that's fine. I did want to ask you, though, about your approach to writing separately. You do write separately quite a bit.
Oh, I do? Think,
yeah, you do. And you really forge your own path in those separate opinions. And just this past term, for example, one of your separate opinions on the application of the Sixth Amendment to the jury trial, right, the Aileen case, to sentencing facts, became the majority view of the court. But others of your separate opinions may be less likely to command a majority view anytime soon.
Maybe like a fine wine, it just needs aging.
Is that your philosophy of separate opinion writing?
Hey, Harlan, it took him 60 years, and he eventually won in Plessy.
Mm-hmm.
I just, you know, you ask a very good question. I think that I may lose, but I think I'm obligated, in fact, encouraged by my colleagues, that if you believe that, you write it. I try not to do it in a way that's not polite or respectful, but I think that someone should have kept writing that segregation was wrong. Regardless of what the precedent was, that I think you have to say certain things. You know, when I first went on the court, people thought, you know, they're great people like Bob Bork, Justice Scalia, the originalists. These are people, everyone thought they were, I guess, not a gimmick, but sort of an oddity. Now, I heard earlier in the introduction, in the earlier speech by Jean Meyer, that originalism now is respected. So they had to do it. And maybe in some of these other cases, we are obligated to say what we really think. In your job, you are more constrained. But you get cases of first impression. And there's precedent, perhaps, that you might question. And you feel obligated to say something. And that's the way I feel. The other thing is that, you know, it was very unpleasant to, in my case, to go to the court for a variety of reasons. And when you go through that, you feel that you are obligated with the blessings that you have, with the opportunities you have to do your job and to stand up for certain principles. And I have to say, I have been encouraged by my colleagues. They have never discouraged me. They have never poo-pooed it. They have their approach, I have mine. But if you notice, in all those cases, I try to do it with a certain degree of respect for my colleagues. Maybe 100 years from now, somebody will excavate and say, this guy was out of his mind. I don't know. But I think that I can, you know, I'm one of these people who still remembers as a little kid standing in the schoolyard and saying the Pledge of Allegiance. I think of little black kids at an all-black school every morning saying the Pledge of Allegiance, that who remembers watching TV sign off at night with the national anthem and the poem High Flight, which you can see on YouTube now. And I still get goosebumps from these things. I still believe in this stuff. I still believe in the Constitution. It means more to me than just an academic document. It's really important. So I feel obligated that the opportunity that I'm given to be there to try to get it right. Mm-hmm. That doesn't mean I have the gospel. I don't think that. It's just an opinion. But if you have it, I think you're obligated to say what it is and why. And if you look like a fool, so what? That's the reason you do the litany of humility. You don't worry about it. You know, you're humble enough to know that perhaps you run the risk in being honest of not necessarily looking like the most acceptable person.
Mm-hmm. You describe having a sense of the weight of history on what you do and the weight of the duty and obligation of the job to get it right every time. I want to ask you now, on a lighter note, how you escape that, the weightiness of your job, and how you escape the cloister of the court. So let's talk about that venerable practice at the Supreme Court known as the summer recess. You are, as I understand it, a famously collegial group of justices. Yes. In spite of your sharp disagreements, there are no scorpions in a bottle on this court. But all of those really hard and closely divided cases at the end of the term must produce some frayed nerves and the need to separate for a while. Is that fair?
Well, I never have a problem with it. I mean, you know, I don't know. I never have a problem. I mean, you know, I go, what's really interesting.
I get out of there as soon as I can.
You know, no, but the truth is that actually, we always have a very pleasant visit before the end of the term. Mm-hmm. And it is, there's some people that you want to take your leave from at the end. But,
well, you've got kind of a different way of unwinding over the summer recess. Some of your colleagues retreat to teaching excursions in Europe and so forth, and you've got a very different style of escaping.
Well, actually, I go to Europe sometime only to come back. I would not be characterized as a Europhile or whatever they call each other. I like the United States. I'm sorry. I do not have... I have nothing against the other countries, but I love the United States. I love this place. I can't get back quick enough. But I'm not really anxious to leave. And about the cloistered life, I love the cloistered life. I was in the seminary. You know, I enjoy going in. As one of my colleague calls me Brother Clarence. I love that. I hear his voice. He comes over to say hello. I love my law clerks. I love my work that I get to do. I have this wonderful, think about it, every day I go in, I have this wonderful opportunity to do this job. Mm-hmm. Sure, I can't tell you that's the way I felt at the beginning, but that's the way I am now. Mm-hmm. I feel blessed every day I drive behind that building to have the chance one more day to go in and be a part of it. I don't care how hard it is. This is not nearly as hard as being in the fields. This is not nearly as hard as picking beans or stripping fodder or plowing. I mean, you walk behind a horse in that Georgia sun, or you do roofing work, or you do sewer work. This is a calling. This is not that bad. This, and think about it. How can you complain that we get a chance to do what we get a chance to do? I love the people I work with. I love seeing them. Some days are better than others. I'm next door to my colleague, Justice Scalia, my friend. You know, I can hear his voice in the hall or something, you know. These are my friends.
Talk about your relationship with your law clerks.
I love my law clerks. I absolutely love my law clerks. This is I tell you before, I have to pick my family. And these kids are my family.
And how do you go about choosing them?
Pretty arbitrarily, but. I didn't want you to think I just randomly hired them or anything. Rely on people I trust. They all clerk for other judges, and the other judges, good friends, send me clerks. You know, I've taken clerks from friends like, you know, Larry Silverman, Steve Williams, Dave Sintel, people I know, Edith Jones. the Armand O'Scanlan, just lots of other judges I know, people who will call me and say, this is a good person. And they know that I don't care which school they went to. It can be LSU or it can be Yale. I hired a small percentage from the Ivies. I hired quite a few more from the non-Ivies, simply because they're smart kids all over the place. But I just, and I try to take them from the South, my part of the country, and I try to prefer kids who are from modest circumstances, whose parents didn't have all the benefits, or didn't have all the advantages. That's just, again, a preference. And I'm not going to bring kids in who disagree on first principles. I'm really not all that interested in arguing with 26-year-olds about that sort of stuff. And I like kids who are not jerks. I require kids to work together, and I just don't need all that disruption in my chambers. So I've been enormously blessed with the kids I've had. Very smart, very pleasant, very hardworking, and they've brought joy to my life. Tomorrow I will have lunch with about 35 former law clerks. We have monthly lunches, and that is one of the high points, monthly high points for me, to see my kids and see how well they're doing.
I understand that you take a pilgrimage to Gettysburg every year with your law clerks, or almost every year.
And poor kids, I drag them there. I take them on my bus. I love going to Gettysburg. At the end of the term, I think that people tend to be a little jaded, a little upset about things. And I'm more idealistic in this job than I was before I took the job. And I want them, after they see a term, I want them to go to Gettysburg and to think about what the price that was paid for this country to exist. We just, thanks to Martha Ann Alito, we saw the Wounded Warriors today. And it is one of the most heartfelt things that I've ever done, to see young people who have been mortally wounded in defense of this nation. And it is hard to see them and not believe that we are doing, that we have an obligation to continue to do the right thing. And what I'm trying to do in taking my clerks to Gettysburg in a small way is to think about Lincoln and that horrible war, that the carnage that took place at Gettysburg. Just think of all the animals that were killed, all the human beings, all the destruction that had occurred there. And he comes there, what, 3-4 months later, what, November 19th, to dedicate this. Four-minute speech, whatever it was. And the things that he said, the eloquence of it, to elevate that tragic moment. And what I'm trying to get these kids to understand is after they see a term, after they see the imperfections, that they still believe, that they're still idealistic. And even with the reality, they still believe that this is important and they understand why. So we go, yes, and I drag them across the battlefield, and I don't feel all that bad about it. But the point is simply to pull it all back together after you see how the sausage is made, that we still believe that it's all worthwhile.
Well, and of course, next week. And of course, next week we'll be celebrating the 150th anniversary of the Gettysburg Address. And I don't know if you have some final thoughts on what Lincoln's words meant to the country then and what they mean to us now.
Well, first of all, I'd like to thank you. And I'd like to thank you all for staying so late to put up with me. Very briefly, Lincoln's word mean a lot to me personally because he was a great emancipator. And I happened to be from the slaves who were affected by Field Order Number 15 after the Emancipation Proclamation. I have to say that the what Lincoln had to say and what he did has affected our country enormously. We know that. But it's affected me too. No 13th Amendment, no 14th Amendment, no 15th Amendment. My life is different. I certainly wouldn't be sitting here. And I certainly wouldn't be sitting on the Supreme Court of the United States. But in his speech, you hear this voice that it's perfectible. The country is perfectible. It's not perfect, but perfectible. And this great war was all about that. And when I go into the building that I work in now, that's the theme I try to carry with me and with my clerks. It's perfectible. It is worth every day getting up and trying to make it right, trying to make it work. But you can't do that if you don't do it on principle. It's not necessarily just about whether it's your methodology is this or that. It is whether or not your principles are right. And they are the principles of this country. So I thank you all. I thank you for this opportunity, and God bless you.